Talking about chaos, the world's economy, we're going to talk about economy today. The economy of the world, the whole world, is in jeopardy. The majority of us, even the well-off, struggle in some way in the economy that we have in the world. And in many cases, we just struggle to make ends meet. You know, the money ends before the month does, as it were. We, even in the most blessed of all nations, in the entire history of the world, in those nations of Israel, certainly in the United States specifically, many struggle, and other parts of the world, the struggle goes even to the extent of struggling for their very survival. Mr. DeCamp has mentioned a project in Angola. You don't have to travel too long in the third, what's known as the third world, to realize what the economic problems in the world really are. And there, we're talking about problems that are on the level of absolute survival. And in some cases, peoples in the church, in various places of the world, if it were not for your offerings and your gentleness of heart and your yearning for them, that starvation would occur even within the church, and that certainly is something that should not be. And that's when things, generally in the world, when things are going good. And then you have earthquakes and volcanoes and tsunamis, and then you have, oh, what's this? What's COVID-19 anyway? What is that? We didn't know what that was a year ago. And yet COVID-19 and pandemics, we had heard of pandemics, but none of us certainly had ever experienced it. They come onto the scene, and so they affect the world's economy like all of these things do. And today, the world's economy is standing on a precipice, standing on the rim of a canyon, leading to not only to economic ruin, but putting human survival itself in jeopardy. And yet, even at the best of times, sometimes we feel like slaves. We feel like slaves without control over our future. But many centuries, millennia ago, God outlined an economic system which, had it been followed, would have led to prosperity for individuals and nations that would have astounded each and every person on earth. It was given to the children of Israel when they came out of Egypt. Now, I was recently asked by a member of the congregation about that system of economy. A system, by the way, which will be used in the world beyond today. It will be instituted, and it will revolutionize the economy of the world. But the question came to me, it says, well, it's outlined there, it's never been used, and that is correct, it has never been used. It has never been tried in the history of the world. And so do we need to consider it today? Is it just there for a nice story? What did God really mean for us to do that? And so today I'd like to present in the form of, a freshman college class. And I've called it God's Economics 101. You know, God's way is very simple. Obey God, and you'll be blessed. That's about as simple as things can come. Obey God, and you will be blessed. Why? Because God is faithful to bless you. And He has the power to do it. He has the ability to control events so that even though every calamity, you live in a town next to a volcano on the seashore and your house undergoes an earthquake when the volcano is spilling out and it creates a tsunami who washes away the countryside, and then COVID-19 comes and parks in your neighborhood. And God can protect you from all of that and bless you in the meantime. So we're going to talk about God's Economic 101. What is it? Why it wasn't used, why it's not used today, what will happen in the future, a future when God's economic plan will be used for the betterment of the entire earth. And the first thing we have to remember, and it's what the world maybe never knew, and if it knew, forgot, and as Mr. DeCampus mentioned, we are seeing seeds within the church planted for evil plants. Planted by Satan, certainly, but using people to put thoughts and ideas that are not appropriate in a godly society. The one thing that we need to remember is that God is a Father. He's also a God of power and of strength, and of knowledge, and intelligence, and mercy, and gentleness. When we need correction, God doesn't wail away with us as hard as He can, because we would just be gone. But corrects us only to the degree, as He did with David, only to the degree that David needed for repentance to come about. And had Saul done that, as Samuel said, Saul's kingdom would have been established forever, just like David's has been established forever. But God is a Father, first and foremost. In spite of being all of those things, His thoughts run to my children. My beloved children, and I want to nurture them. I want to give to them. I want to protect them. I want to provide the good things for my children to ensure that they have hopes and they have dreams to dream and things to expect and pleasant times in the future. He has and is and will always intend for a blessing to come to us with sound economic principles that He has given us. Let's look at what God's attitude is. I want to start, in fact, with a Psalm of David. This is Psalm 36. And in this Psalm, David's talking about God's intent to satisfy those who trust Him, to satisfy His children. In Psalm 36, let's look at starting in verse 5. And here David is talking to the very attitude of God. It says, "Your loving kindness, O Lord, is in the heavens. Your faithfulness reaches to the sky. It just expands to everywhere. Your righteousness. God is right. Everybody else, if they have an attitude other than God's, is not right. And we will see that extends to economic principles as well. Your righteousness is like the great mountain. Your judgments are like the great deep. O Lord, you preserve man and beast. How precious is your loving kindness, O God. Therefore, the children of men take refuge under the shadow of your wings. Under the shadow of your wing. If you come from a farming background, you understand that image. And it's an image that God uses, has used many times in the scriptures. When Jesus Christ was lamenting over Jerusalem, when he said, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you know, I wanted to be like a mother hen who spread out her wings and shadowed and protected you, but you wouldn't do it. You wouldn't do it." And other scriptures, Psalm 91 talks about under the shadow of the Almighty. And picture in your mind, if you will, if you've ever seen this, it has real meaning. You look out into a barnyard. And I go back to both sets of grandparents, chickens. And the chickens run free and the eggs are more nutritious that way. But she has chicks, and chicks are these furry, fluffy little creatures that cheep, 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 cheep and run all over the barnyard. And then Mama sees a hawk soaring overhead, and she'll cluck, cluck, that special cluck, and those little chicks will scurry as hard and fast as they can. And meantime, she'll spread out her wings like this, and she'll rattle those wings, and those chicks will just scurry underneath the shadow of her wings for the protection, and they'll bundle around her legs and thus be out of the sight of the danger that is overhead. They shall be abundantly satisfied, talking about those people who rely on God, with the richness of your house. Speaking of God, what is the richness of God's house? As David said, "And I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." "And you shall make them drink of the river of your pleasures. For with you is the fountain of life. In your light," of course we know that Jesus Christ is the light of the world, "in your light we shall see light." Well, and then in John the 10th chapter, we see something that gives us even greater understanding about what God's attitude is with regard to how He takes care of us, how He takes care of His children. And here we're talking about the goodness of God. In John the 10th chapter and in verse 9, it talks about Jesus Christ speaking of Himself, saying, "I am the door, I am the way in. I am the way that you get into the household of God." And it says, "If anyone enters through me," and that is the only way you can enter into the kingdom of God, "he shall be saved. And shall go in and out and find pasture." Again, David talked so much about finding pasture. And the pastures that David was talking about, if we look at those pastures, they look like a desert. And yet there are little tufts of grass here and little tufts of grass there, and there's always enough. And the shepherd leads his sheep to the pasture, and it's not like a horse field, a horse pasture here in Kentucky, which is lush and green and every square inch is covered by grass, but there's enough. And it says, the thief does not come except to steal and kill and destroy. And certainly Satan is the thief. I have come so that they may have life and may have it. God's attitude, may have life and may have it in abundance. And so we see that God's idea is to do good for his children, to do by expansion good for the entire world. Of the increase of his government, there shall be no end. It starts with us, brethren, us here in the church, looking at the attitude of God and trying to see that attitude reflected off us to the world around us. It's not our goodness, it's God's goodness that reflects from us and through us. But there's continues to be controversy about the best economic system in the world. The best thing going for the well-being of man. What system should society use for our economy? And we have great PhDs formulating concepts of economic principles. And now we see these things even more and more in the church itself. And when you consider the economies of the nations, you have to consider that they are always connected with a political system. Economy is never presented in and of itself. Oh, all right, we're going to have this economy and we're going to have this form of government over here. No, they always pair. And even God's economic system pairs with his, if you want to call it that, his political system. It's not politics, it's rule, system of rule. And they are never presented in isolation. They are all inextricably connected to one another. For instance, there are two basic economic systems in the world today. When you choose one of those economic systems, you automatically choose a political system to go with it because they are always connected. On the political right, you want to guess what economic system the political right has chosen? Well, of course you know. They're called conservatives. Conservatives. And that's a government, the political right, they use terms like capitalism and free market economy. And I guarantee you, brethren, you do not want a free market economy. Because free market economy means there are no rules for the economy. Anything goes. Now, as it has been formulated and used, people consider that freedom in economy is a good thing, but there are always constraints and there are always rules that have to be followed to make it work. There is no pure economic system in the world today. Capitalism is not pure, but I'm getting ahead of myself, so let me back up just for a second. Political right, conservatives, less government control, greater individual freedom to decide what goes on within that economy. And that's counterbalanced with the political left, You know which party I'm talking about. And you know which economic system I'm talking about. I don't have to explain this in detail. You see it pointed out to you every day. They're called liberal. And more lately, they're called progressive. They're progressive in their own eyes, but it's a progression from where we are to where they want us to be. And it involves greater governmental control with less individual freedom to decide how it's to be implemented. Now, to say a little something about individual freedom, there's a lot of discussion about rats. My rats. Reminds me of a line out of the movie Gettysburg. When one Yankee soldier is talking to a Confederate soldier that they've captured, says, "Why are you fighting?" And the Yankee soldier was from Maine, so it's very proper New England diction, you know. And the Confederate soldier says, "I'm fighting for my rats." He says, You're fighting for your rats? He said, "Yeah, I need to have the rat to do what I want to do." Well, then the Union soldier understood. A lot of discussion about my rights. What is my right? I have the right to do this, that, or the other, even if it defrauds you of your right. Apostle Paul mentioned something about that, and he says, "Why are you going to court with one another? Why are you having this controversy? It would be better if you allowed yourself to be defrauded so you wouldn't have this controversy and this necessity to go out to the legal system." Because why? Because we are in the house of God. And the controversies between us get solved by the application of love and concern and consideration for one another, just like God the Father and Jesus Christ do with us. Decisions are made for those reasons. And neither the political right and nor the political left and their conservative or their progressive economic systems, neither of them exist in its purest form, the form they want it to exist in. It's always somewhere in the middle here, a mix of everything. And so in capitalism, we have private or corporate, by definition, private or corporate ownership. And in terms of a free market system, there is zero governmental control, including all the way to the extent of the existence of a black market. Black market. And even a black market has control because you have the mob that controls the sales and the buying within that system. But by definition, a free market would have no controls whatsoever. And so the goal of capitalism, really, if you think about it, is those with capital have a full reign and control of the system. Okay, in its purest form, the goal of capitalism would be based on squeezing the maximum possible gain or capital out of each and every transaction. What's the flaw in all that? The flaw in capitalism is the same as the flaw in socialism and in communism, and that is greed. Greed is always the thing that destroys. It's the fly in the ointment, if you please. The few in capitalism. The captains of industry, the richest men in the world, dominate due to, number one, their skill at making money, their skill at reading the stock market, their skill at, and sometimes their chicanery at doing that, in gathering capital around themselves. And the old saying is, you got to have money to make money. If you want to be successful in a capitalist system, it really helps if you have capital, if you have money. And their only restraint is their skill in negotiation. And it comes to a system of let the buyer beware, caveat emptor in the Latin. All sales are final. If I got you, I got you. The one who dies with the most toys wins. Capitalism. Well, what about communism? Communism is shown to be the failed economic system. It is a system that, to most people in the world, except Cuba and North Korea, there are the only two remaining capitalist economies in the world in its most pure form. In communism, productivity in its purest form is to be divided evenly across the society. In communism, all social and economic issues are controlled by a single totalitarian state dominated by single self-perpetuating political party. One party, and most usually one person in charge, and they take, and they're supposed to take the entire produce, the entire product of everybody's effort. And that one individual then is supposed to divide it evenly across the entirety of society so that the poorest all the way up to the richest have the same amount. What is the flaw in that system? I need a new Dhaka on the Black Sea. You know, well, I need that because, you know, it's a quiet place and we can get away and we can make policy decisions for the nation on how to, I need a new car to drive to my new Dhaka on the Black Sea. And, well, I can't be there by myself, so my buddy over here, he needs a new Dhaka on the Black Sea. You know, he needs a new villa overlooking the beauty of the Black Sea, and he needs a car. And so graft and corruption and greed intervene to make the purity of the system work. And if there's one thing that you can count on, it is greed. And the political system becomes dominated by individuals who cater to themselves and to their cronies. And what does it do to the rest of the people? I'm a hard worker. I take pride in my work. I'm going to apply myself to succeed. And I work, and this ne'er-do-well down the road who won't lift a finger for his next meal, well, he gets the same thing I do. Now, wait a minute. Let me think about this. If I become a ne'er-do-well and do nothing, then I'll get the same thing he does. So why should I work? Why should I apply myself? And so you can't work hard and prosper. So why work hard? And so the system fails. It is oppressive. It discourages personal effort. And it's subject to abuse. And it fails to meet the needs of the people because of the attitudes. Now, it was once stated that the church in Acts, the fourth chapter, was a communistic system. You know, they had everything in common. But so many times within Scripture, we see that Jesus Christ endorses private ownership. And if you read through Acts 4, you talk about people going to their house. They shared their goods, and people sold their properties that they had. But further on, it still talks about their house. So it was an attitude of giving, but it was not a communistic system. Socialism, similar to communism, except that the produce of everybody's effort is divided equally by society, not this totalitarian government, but by social consent among everybody. And so it vests the ownership of all of society's goods, its production, its capital, its land, that's shared across the entire social landscape. And it's done by government distribution and redistribution as necessary so that everybody has the same. And so it is that the society then decides who gets what. What's the flaw in that? Why? Greed is the flaw in that. We have our narratives, each and every one of us, and groups of us have a narrative. We have these narratives, and the narrative of one group of in society rewards those who are socially correct and penalize those who don't share our narrative. They are thus socially incorrect. It's used as a tool to drive societal goals. And it discourages the behavior of those who oppose us. And so we see that in the panoply of basic economic structure that Satan has embroiled mankind in a system of constant confusion based on social, political issues with tailored economic systems to go with it, and it has delivered to us a death pill for each, based upon our individual nature and our individual proclivities. They're all from Satan. Capitalism is from Satan. Socialism is from Satan. Communism is from Satan. Conservatism is from Satan. And the far left ideas, they're all from Satan. Satan doesn't care how he destroys us. He's got something for everybody. They're all from Satan. And they have collectively brought us to the edge of destruction, all on the basis of our greediness. But God, on the other hand, as we previously stated, created a system that contained none of these flaws. In other words, there's no greediness. It's a system that's never been used and incorporates the positive things out of every one of those negative systems. And it would solve all the economics of the world. Let's turn to Exodus, the 23rd chapter, because that's where God initially started talking about it. Exodus 23. Exodus 23, and we'll go to verse 9 to begin with. Also, and you know when I said that greed was the flaw in all these systems? In starting to present his system, what's the first thing that God says here in verse 9? Also, you shall not oppress a stranger. You shall not oppress. God's system will only work with a godly society and godly attitudes. You shall not oppress a stranger. Why? Why shouldn't I oppress a stranger? Because you know the heart of a stranger. You've been there. You've done that. Since you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You know what it's like to be on the receiving end of not oppressing a stranger. That's sort of like, you know, the statement, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Oh, I know what it's like. It hurt. It didn't feel good. So I don't want to do that to somebody else. Don't oppress the stranger because you were strangers and you know what it's like. And then it starts laying out the system. It starts with laying out a subject called the land Sabbath. What? What's the economic system got to do with this? And you shall sow your land 6 years, and you shall gather in the fruit of it. Okay, 6 years, 6 years, okay. But the seventh year you shall let it rest. It'll have a Sabbath. It'll rest and lie still. So, and so we see sort of like tithing. God owns it all, and he only asks 1/7 of it for a given reason. That's sort of like tithing. You know, God gives you a dollar, and you get to keep 90 cents. But you have to give back that dime, that 10 cents, for another use, for God, and the uses that God dictates and decides. So it's sort of like tithing, but it's sort of like the Sabbath. And it continues in verse 11, but the seventh year you let it rest and lie still. Why? So that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave, the animals of the field shall eat. In the same way you shall deal with your vineyard and with your olive grove. So fields, vineyards, and olive groves. Those three things. Fields, vineyards, and olive groves. And it's so that you can have and express the heart of God in your activity. It doesn't have that system of greed. It doesn't have that fatal flaw. And then, and so you'll sow on, verse 10, you'll sow on the sixth, but not on the seventh. And it creates what is known as a land Sabbath. Then let's go to verse 12. And it draws an exact parallel between that and the Sabbath day. 6 days you shall do your work, and on the seventh you shall rest, so that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the son of your handmaid and the stranger may be rejuvenated. And you really think about it, shall be restored, shall be given a blessing. And this is the reason, from your effort, the effort that God gives you to do on the land that God gives you as a blessing for other people, so that the poor may eat fields, vineyards, and olive groves. So how is it exactly that others benefit? Well, let's just go on. Let's shift over to Leviticus, the 25th chapter here. In Leviticus, the 25th chapter, let's look at verse 2. And this is the situation where God is instructing Moses to let the children of Israel know about the laws and the things that he wanted them to observe. And he says, Moses, speak to the children of Israel, verse 2, and say to them, when you come into the land which I give you, you know, it's mine, so it comes as a blessing to you, then shall the land keep a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall sow your field 6 years, and you shall prune your vineyard 6 years, and gather in the fruit of it. But in the seventh year shall be a Sabbath of rest to the land, a Sabbath for the Lord. You shall neither sow, you shall neither show your field nor prune your vineyard. And by way of going back and looking at the scripture in Exodus, also not your olive grove. You shall not reap that which sows of its own accord. What? You're not even supposed to use what grows up by itself? Well, not quite. It says, for your harvest. So if something grows up on that year in the land Sabbath, don't go out and pick every bit of it that you can and then take it to the market and sell it, you see. You don't do that. It says, you don't do that for your harvest, neither gather the grapes of your undressed vines as a harvest. It is a year of rest to the land. Scientifically, it's been shown that if periodically you rotate your crops and periodically you let land lie fallow, the beneficial microbes within the soil grow and replenish. The earthworms do their bit and they loosen the soil, and there is a better capacity to grow in subsequent years. And so it's a system that that is self-perpetuating, and it shall be food for you and for your servants and for your slave women and for your hired servant and for your stranger who stays with you, for your livestock, verse 7. And then it goes on to expand the system even beyond that, because then it says, and so you do this every 7 years and you benefit from it, and all the people of the land benefit from it. But then on year 49, 7 times 7, so 7 sets of 7 years, in that 49th year, you know, it's a seventh year. So the 49th year is going to be a land Sabbath year. But then he says, hang on. This is God saying, and then on the 50th year, you're going to have a year of release, what they call a year of release. And it was established to be on the Day of Atonement. Verse 9, then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month in the Day of Atonement. The trumpet shall sound throughout all of your land. And what goes on there? What goes on then? Let's look at the word trumpet. There is the shofar or the ram's horn. And the sound of that trumpet the sound of the trumpet is from Strong's word 7782, which is from the root of the Hebrew that's listed in Strong's 8231. In its original sense, it means the sound is giving a sound that is incise. That means very sharp and clear and unmistakable. So it is a sound that instantly you recognize, and you recognize the purpose of it. And Jubilee, because this is the trumpet of Jubilee, and Jubilee is from Strong's 8643, and it is teruah. And it refers to the sound of joy. So this is the sharp, incisive tone of joy. And that's, you think about it, our word in English of jubilation. And it is a feeling of great happiness and triumph. You want to know what happiness and triumph is? I was watching a basketball tournament one time. Our team, University of Kentucky. You know, the only team that really matters. Our team was playing, I think it was North Carolina. Always a great rivalry. It was in a tournament. I think maybe the SEC tournament that year would have been 1970, 71 or so. And I was with a group of other people watching the game. And we were behind in the second half. And our boys made a valiant effort to cut the loss. And with seconds to play, and I'm talking less than 10 seconds to play in the game, Kentucky was down by one. Somebody fumbled the ball, and it came into Kentucky's possession on the far end of the court. And so the ball went into play, and while the clock ticked, ticked, ticked down, a shot was released, and they were down by 1 point. By 1 point at that time. A shot was released, and as the shot was in motion, arching toward the goal, the end of the game, 0 seconds resulted. And your world hangs in suspense at that point. And that ball, everybody's watching breathlessly. And that ball hit directly into the hoop. And Kentucky was up and won the game. What did the people do? Oh, let me get my stuff here. Let me get ready to go. The game's over. No, it was, hey! Throughout the entire crowd. Or, oh, on the other side. That is the incisive sound of jubilation and triumph. And when that day comes in the world tomorrow, when that day comes, that is the sense of what it will be like on the day of jubilation, the day of the sound of the jubilee in the kingdom of God. Jesus Christ is not coming back to this earth as a Republican. He is not coming back as a Democrat. He's not even coming back as a Republicrat. But he is coming back as an absolute totalitarian ruler of this entire world. He and he alone will be in charge. Not Joseph Stalin, not Adolf Hitler, not Donald Trump, not Joe Biden. Jesus Christ King of kings and Lord of lords will be in charge, and he will be and have totalitarian rule. And his economic system will come with him. And it will be a system like the world has never seen, and because of their greed, has never practiced. And you know what? The produce, the land itself, as the land division in Joshua, when all of the land of Israel was divided to each and every family. That's Joshua chapter 14 through 17, if you want to look there. Including even to the daughters of the children of Israel. In Joshua 17, verses 1 through 4, there was a family that had no sons. So there was no dispensing of the land to them. Had no sons. So the request went out and God said, yeah, that's right. Had no sons? Give it to the daughters. That will establish the families, and all of the families will have their own land. You know what else happens on the Jubilee? Number one, in Leviticus 25 and verse 10, it says it's holy. You shall make the 50th year holy and proclaim liberty. Liberty? Does that mean I get to go out and do whatever I want to? What do you mean? In God's kingdom? Any kind of evil I can come up with, I get to do? No. Liberty, though, means that you become free. In the year of Jubilee, all debt is canceled. All slavery. If you were in slavery, you're free. You have liberty. And it sure gives meaning to this concept of lack of being bound in restraints. Economically, you get your land back. You get your land, you go back to your homeland. You are restored. You are redeemed. And you are given that freedom back. You know, we rejected law, God as our ruler. We rejected God as the provider of our economic system. That story is spelled out in 1 Samuel, the 8th chapter, where the children of Israel said, don't want God, want a king. Want a king, just like all the nations around them. Want a king. But God told them, told Samuel, said, go ahead and give them a king. Do what they want. But before you do, here's what's going to happen. He's going to take your children. He's going to take your sons and your daughters. He's going to take the best. He's going to take... That's economic, brethren. If the king comes in and takes your sheep and the best of them, that's economics. And the king's economics go with the king's rule. And in the world tomorrow and to the world beyond today, I still use the term the world tomorrow, Jesus Christ's economics will come into play as well. In the world beyond today. Well, incidentally, in Leviticus 26:34, God says something. It says, because you've relied on kings, because you've relied on your economic system, you're going into captivity. And you know what? Leviticus 26 and verse 34. He says, then shall the land enjoy its Sabbaths, its rest, as long as it lies waste. He says, all the time you are in captivity, the land is going to get what you cheated it of all of these years. As long as you're laboring in the hands of your enemies, and then shall the land rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. But for a final scripture, I want you to turn over to Micah. Right after the book of Jonah, right before the book of Nahum, in case you're having trouble finding that. Micah 4, we'll start in verse 1 because it gives the time frame. It shows clearly that this is something that is going to be in the future, in the last days, that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established in the top, or overtop all of the mountains or governments, and it shall be exalted above the hills, those little governments, and people shall flow to it. Why are they going to flow to it? Because things are good there. And many nations shall come and say, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. Why? Because we like what we hear, and He will teach us His ways, and we will walk in His paths. For the law shall go forth out of Zion, including the law of the land Sabbath, including the law of the Jubilee, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, and He shall judge among many people, and will rebuke strong nations afar off, who still have this thought and idea of capitalism or socialism or whateverism. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And nation shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. So there is peace, right? But what will happen? All of these people that went back to their homeland, all of these people that went back to their little plot, all of these people that have been given harvests from God, and they shall sit each one under his own vine and under his own fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. For the mouth of the Eternal of Hosts has spoken it. That's why. And so as you sit there and you trust God and you pick that fig off of the tree and you pop it into your mouth, that will taste so good.